Hello, my name is Kasia Krzyżanowska and I am the RevDem editor. My guest today is Rochelle Terman, an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Chicago. And last year, she has published a book, The Geopolitics of Shaming, When Human Rights Pressure Works and When It Backfires, with Princeton University Press. And this book is the topic of our today's conversation. So welcome, Rochelle.
Thank you for having me.
So let's go straight to the first question that I have for you. So how do you define basically the politics of shaming in international relations? Why do you think shaming is a powerful tool of norm enforcement in international politics? And what is its place among other international measures like economic sanctions or the withdrawal of foreign aid?
Great. So when international relations scholars talk about shaming, what we're referring to is something not unlike shaming between individuals, actually. It's the application of social sanctions to enforce a norm. In the international realm, that comes from states, human rights organizations like Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch. Sometimes it goes through the United Nations. It's all the exertion of moral pressure on countries that violate norms like human rights. So, for example, when Amnesty International asks you to sign a petition on behalf of a political prisoner in China, or the United Nations issues a resolution condemning state violence in Syria, that's shaming. It's putting the country in the spotlight, condemning violations, and urging reform. And shaming is by far the most common tool to enforce human rights and humanitarian norms. Sometimes we'll see other methods of enforcement, like economic sanctions or military intervention, but only the most powerful states can afford to do that, right? Shaming, on the other hand, is practiced routinely by virtually every state in the modern era. And I focus on, especially when states criticize other states. The consensus in many areas of IR, not all, but for many observers, shaming is one of the best tools that we have to combat human rights violations. The idea is that shaming isolates a regime from the international community, embarrasses its leaders, which then incentivizes governments to comply with human rights norms in order to maintain legitimacy. Shaming could also mobilize domestic opposition in the target state, which could then put pressure on policymakers from their own population. My research challenges that conventional wisdom. I start with the observation that in many cases, shaming not only fails to induce compliance, but could incite a backlash, provoking resistance, even worsening human rights practices. So the main question or questions that I seek to answer is, when does shaming lead to an improvement in human rights conditions and when does it backfire? And in cases where it does backfire, why do actors do it in the first place?
Yeah, sure. Thank you for this overview. And you mentioned that shaming is the most common tool routinely used by the states. But then again, it's not so common to some areas of human rights violations are not covered. So what causes international shaming in the first place? And what is the logic behind this mechanism of international attention being paid to some human rights violations while others are exactly ignored? So in other words, how does the global morality market operate?
Yeah, you put it very well. Some human rights violations receive a lot of attention, and others hardly get either any attention, or if they do get attention, a lot of states aren't willing to criticize or condemn them. So shaming can be risky, even if it's purely rhetorical. It has the risks of alienating potential friends and allies. So, for example, many countries, including Muslim countries, have refused to condemn China's alleged abuse of the Uyghurs because they fear undermining this valuable strategic relationship. The United States was reluctant to shame Saudi Arabia over the death of Jamal Khashoggi in 2018, and we've protected Saudi Arabia's rights violations for a long time. And that's because human rights are a touchy subject, and Saudi Arabia did not appreciate being criticized in this area, threatened to retaliate economically. Those are called enforcement costs. Just the basic idea that shaming can be potentially costly for the shamer. So then, but at the same time, we still see states do it quite often. So I think that states choose to shame norm violations for three reasons. The first is simply to enforce a desired norm of behavior. So I might shame someone I see littering in the park, for example, because I don't like being surrounded by trash and I want that person to pick up their waste. So that's kind of the most straightforward motivation, right? But at least when it comes to human rights, even the beneficiaries of human rights are citizens in other countries, right? So that even if leaders can genuinely believe in the Global Human Rights Project, it can often be difficult to overcome those enforcement costs strictly by trying to enforce this desired norm. But there are these two other motivations that come into play. They're social rewards. The first is that states shame norm violations to collect rewards from audiences. So I might see someone litter in the park and I shame them, not necessarily because I think that they're going to comply with my demands, but because maybe I get some reward from those around me who also don't like to see waste and littering. In the international realm, that can be domestic publics, those can be international audiences. The idea is that by publicly enforcing norms, you are pleasing third-party audiences that genuinely believe in human rights and want to see them protected. The third reason is to stigmatize the target or degrade its status on the world stage. Okay? And you see that kind of weaponized shaming a lot. So think about the Cold War, for example. The United States was stigmatizing the Soviet Union, accusing it of publicizing human rights violations. The Soviet Union was doing the exact same thing to the United States, publicizing stuff like racial discrimination and so on. So those social reasons are important because they explain how shaming can be rational, even when it's not expected to work. By work, I mean result in compliance. And that's because compliance isn't necessarily the only goal. If your goal is to stigmatize your opponent, that kind of weaponized shaming, you might actually want to see them continue violating human rights because it provides additional opportunities to stigmatize them.
Yeah, thank you. So you answered the question about the stigmatizing other countries in self-interest of the stigmatizing country as well. But let us now focus on the target state. So somehow counterintuitively, you found that international shaming can lead to defensive reactions among the domestic human rights actors. So when does shaming related to human rights violations backfires and actually exacerbates these violations? If there is evidence of ignoring or even doubling down the violations and negative domestic reactions to shaming arise, why do the shaming countries continue their international practices?
Shaming can backfire by sparking a negative reaction in the targeted state, especially from public audiences, domestic audiences. The great insight here is that people typically resent being told what to do. It's pretty intuitive, but especially by foreign actors, and they respond defensively. So, in light of that defensive reaction, leaders in the target state can be rewarded for standing up to international pressure, defending the nation against this perceived attack. And meanwhile, leaders that quote unquote give in and comply with foreign demands might have their political legitimacy undermined at home. So the result is that violations could persist or even exacerbate. And that can happen even if leaders have a little ideological motivation, as you say, to pursue violations. So, for example, some reporters observed that in 2009, when Uganda proposed a version of its anti-homosexuality bill, there was a lot of shaming from Western states. President Museveni, by all accounts, preferred a more moderate solution. But precisely because he was shamed so publicly by Western states, he was really backed into a corner. He couldn't, veto the bill or get rid of it because that would be incredibly domestically unpopular. So he signed the bill kind of quite ostentatiously in front of the eyes of the international community and so on. So all that raises, a question, as you said, which is, is if it backfires, why do it? And I think it goes deeper than just short-sightedness or strategic blunders. The key point is that political actors, as I explained earlier, shame not only or even primarily to compel compliance. For states wishing to stigmatize their geopolitical rivals, for example, that kind of defensive backlash isn't just acceptable, it might even be welcome, because it provides those additional opportunities to tarnish the target's legitimacy. So that's why in the book I explain that interaction as endogenous. It just means that there's this structure of underlying incentives for both parties that fuels both really harsh enforcement, but also backlash. As you can think of it as kind of like a shame defiance spiral.
I think it's a nice metaphor of this spiral. You wrote in the book that the critic, and I quote, matters as much as perhaps more than the criticism. And I find it very illuminating. So how important for the shamed government's behavior is the close relationship with the shaming state? What are the examples of a broader effect of the geopolitics of shaming? And how tangible such system-level trends, as you name them, are and what they are dependent on?
Right. So, in my view, the relationship between shamer and target is absolutely critical. And that relationship is historical, it's economic, it's geopolitical, it's strategic. The basic intuition is that shaming means very different things when it comes from friends and when it comes from enemies. Criticism that's coming from a strategic partner is more costly. Right. You have a relationship with this actor. You want to maintain that relationship. If they're mad at you, then that is forceful. It's also more credible. It's just more credible because there are few in strategic incentives to criticize your friends, right? There's no incentive to lie. So shaming in that case serves as this credible signal. It signals that human rights violations really did happen. There and in that case, the target's more likely to take that criticism seriously and comply in order to, not only to maintain a valued relationship with their legitimacy writ large. The problem is that kind of shaming that comes from your geopolitical or strategic friends and allies, that rarely happens. More often, countries are shamed by their geopolitical rivals. And that's less costly, less forceful, right? Because there's no valued relationship to protect, there are few incentives to make the shamer happy by complying with their demands. Plus, those kind of accusations are often less credible. They're seen as a kind of cynical attempt to sully the target's reputation. And all of that allows the target to deny, reject the accusations. It can even make sense, as we discussed earlier, for the target governments to double down in defiance of shaming. And that's because if those relevant audiences also have an antagonistic relationship to the shamer, right? When leaders violate their norms, it generates these tangible political rewards. So, because of these incentives, we have something like a paradox. We have a system where adversaries are quick to condemn human rights abuses, but often provoke a counterproductive response. allies are the most effective enforcers of human rights norms, but they're often reluctant to do it in the first place. So shaming is most common in situations where it's least likely to be effective.
Would you like to elaborate on the system level trends in the case of conflict between Israel and Palestine?
So the politicization, this is what we're talking about, right? The politicization of human rights, and I think it's very much on display when it comes to Israel. On the one hand, many Israelis are very suspicious of international institutions and international criticism, and it's not too difficult to see why. The former UN Human Rights Committee and the current Human Rights Council has been accused of anti-Israel bias, promoting double standards. For example, I think the Human Rights Council has passed more resolutions condemning Israel than the rest of the world combined. So you'll often hear that criticism from Israel, but also some places in Europe, certainly the United States, that the international human rights mechanisms and organs disproportionately focus on Israel. That's important because it's kind of seen as weaponized and motivated by these hostile anti-Israel, even anti-Semitic motivations. And not surprisingly, that those criticisms don't tend to work very well on Israeli public opinion. If anything, it kind of drives those defensive reactions. There is an interesting study that showed that international criticism in the form of like threats of economic sanctions actually increased support for hardline right-wing policies, even among Israelis who are on the left. So even among Israelis who would be otherwise sympathetic to the the issue of settlements, for example, they would act the international criticism kind of pushed them further to the right. So that's one perspective on the situation. On the other hand, I think it's also pretty clear that Israel's allies, especially the United States, make a concerted effort to protect human rights, or excuse me, protect Israel from legitimate human rights criticism because of our own geopolitical interests. So the politicization works both ways here. For Israel, and has been in some ways unfairly demonized, but also unfairly protected in the international realm. And in fact, you kind of can't have one without the other. For many countries, South Africa, for example, they see it for a long time, hypocrisy in the way that countries are punished for war crimes, in the International Criminal Court, through military intervention. When historically, when humanitarian norms have been enforced, they've mostly been in the global south, and the United States, Western countries have been protected. So I think all of that helps to understand the significance of South Africa, specifically bringing these charges. This is a country with a very recent history of apartheid and racist violence, which is supported by the United States and Israel for a long time. Palestine is a very prominent issue there since its founding. So by enforcing the anti-genocide norm, Israel's reaction to the ICJ cases is almost is important, but it's not the most it's not the only motivation for South Africa, is the point. Is that even if it doesn't, if this ICJ case has no effect on Israel, there might be very good reasons for South Africa to bring the case, to prosecute the case, to attempt to enforce this norm, because they are enforcing, what in my framework are called meta norms, the norm to enforce a norm. It's South Africa is being encouraged. It's benefiting in its own image in some sense by punishing what many people around the world see as clear, horrific, brutal, abuses. So, do I think that the ICJ case will deter Israel in any way? No, not by itself. But one thing it could do is to mobilize international pressure, excuse me, mobilize political pressure in the United States. If international pressure is going to have any impact on curtailing the destruction in Gaza, it has to come from the United States. Because that's not because the United States has any moral high ground, just that it shares a strategic relationship with Israel and has protected it for so long. So if we actually put our strategic influence on the line here, that could actually have an impact. And that's why many people in the United States are pressuring Biden to do something, because it would be the most effective, but it's also going to be the hardest thing to mobilize.
Sure. It's a follow-up question. Just how do you assess the measures decided by the ICJ? Do you think they are somehow groundbreaking or very important for the case, or just normal measures adjusted in this case, in such cases?
Do you mean like the preliminary ruling last week, or I think that, in all honesty, I'm not an expert in international law, and so I would love to talk to a lawyer, an international a lawyer that's working in international law to know the legal significance of it. But I'm particularly interested in the political significance of it, because the ICJ has no enforcement power, really. So it if it's going to have a practical impact, it's going to be through, in my view, mobilizing third-party countries, especially the United States. I think I saw a poll that recently that among Israelis, Jewish Israelis, half of the population think that that ruling was too harsh, even though in many, it didn't actually accuse find Israel guilty of genocide or anything. They still found it too harsh. So at least when it comes to the practical political significance of it, I think a lot of people are trying to figure out a way to impose, to apply international law fairly and principally and without politics. But in my view, politics is absolutely essential and inescapable, because the only way that, as I mentioned, that international efforts are going to actually have an effect is through political leverage, especially from the states that have a lot of political leverage over Israel, i.e., the United States. I'm sorry, I know that didn't really quite answer your question, but at least, that's how I understand it, how I see it.
Sure. Thank you. So coming back now, maybe to your book again, because you analyzed the UN Human Rights Council review system, which was also very interesting. And based on that, what kind of human rights topics are safe to tackle by a geopolitical partner, and which are less likely to be discussed in such a system? And how do the target states actually respond to the UN Council recommendations?
Yeah, let me give a very quick background context, which I think will help us understand the significance of this. So the United Nations Human Rights Council organizes this process. It's called the Universal Periodic Review, or UPR for short. And the goal is to periodically review the human rights situation of every member of the United Nations. The way that it works is through a system of peer review. So a country like the United States goes up for review every 4 or 4.5 years, and then every other country has the opportunity to offer feedback in the form of these specific recommendations. Okay. I recommend, country might say, I recommend that you abolish the death penalty. It's a very common recommendation against the United States. And then the state under review has to publicly respond and decide whether or not it accepts or rejects each recommendation. Basically, you can see this is whether it sees each recommendation as legitimate or not. So the UPR offers this really fascinating laboratory for the study of international shaming, and we can use statistical analysis to see what the effects are from the strategic relationship between the one issuing the recommendation and the ones receiving the recommendation. And it turns out that strategic relationships do play a really important process. So, in the first place, states tend to go easier on their friends in the review process. They're less severe in their commentary and they shy away, as you pointed out, from super sensitive topics. The basic intuition is that some human rights issues are more sensitive than others. Rights like free speech, torture, genocide, could those kinds of accusations could really undermine the stability of the ruling regime for example, by fostering political competition. Those abuses are directly attributable to state agents, right? Whereas other rights, the right to health, the right to development, those are less threatening to target regimes because the violations of those rights tend to reside in the private sphere or because of a lack of capacity. It's one thing to say, actively chose to torture my political rival. It's another thing to say, if I could provide universal health care to my entire population, I would, but we just don't have the resources, you know? So, because of that, another example is women's rights. Actually, a lot of the substantive commentary in this process has to do with women's rights. But the specific issues that we're talking about are things like trafficking. Think about trafficking, for example. What do you do to protect women from trafficking? You increase police presence, you increase surveillance and state control. The violators in those cases are tend to be private actors or not government actors. The point is that if I receive a recommendation on trafficking, it's not as costly to me as an accusation of torture or violating speech or something like that, right? They're kind of social problems that are easy to embrace because they don't threaten the power of the incumbent regime. So you can, those types of things, women's rights, often rights of the child, trafficking, right to health, they become something like a safety valve in the human rights regime. It provides an opportunity for states to appear like they are diligently participating in human rights institutions, holding other states accountable, performing those meta norms that I mentioned earlier, the norm to enforce norms. But at the same time, they can do that without seriously confronting their geopolitical allies, without undermining their strategic interests. So we see that states are kind of go easy on their friends. And by the same token, countries are more likely to criticize their adversaries on particularly sensitive issues. You know, so if you compare the United States review of Saudi Arabia to the United States review of Iran, for example, they share many things in common, share many record similar records of human rights violations. But the United States, when we're reviewing issuing feedback to Saudi Arabia, tend to focus on things like women's rights and not on things like murdering journalists and torture. But we go particularly harsh on Iran because we have an adversarial relationship. So the last thing, turning to the state under review, the target state. Remember that those states have to publicly decide whether or not they accept or reject each recommendation. The basic point is that states respond very differently depending on who the recommendation is coming from. So states are more likely to accept criticism coming from their geopolitical friends. And that's even after controlling for the content of the recommendation. So, in other words, if I'm a state, I get a specific recommendation from a friend. I get the exact same recommendation in terms of content, in terms of substance from my adversary. I'm more likely to accept the one from my adversary and reject the one, excuse me, accept the one from my ally and reject the one from my adversary.
So let's talk about those constant target states. When does the label of human rights violator become an ontological one? So it becomes imposed as a stigma. if a country is shamed as a human rights violator, but then improves the situation, does the international community somehow change the shaming label, or it just stays with the country forever?
That's a great question, because in the international realm, much like the interpersonal realm, states have reputations, and those reputations can be sticky, meaning that they can persist even when objective attributes or behavior change. And they can be internalized even. As an identity of a state. So some states might actually embrace the label or embrace the stigma. If I'm stigmatized by my political adversary, it's not necessarily something, maybe I could wear it as a badge of honor, or a signal of pride, for example. That being said, there are situations in which reputations change drastically, but they tend to be during a period of profound transition. So I'm thinking of Germany, for example, after World War II, or South Africa, after the fall of the apartheid regime, or Iran, after the Islamic Revolution, when we have kind of these drastic changes in the governing structure of states. But I think even in those cases, whether it's coming from the international community or it's coming from within the internal conversation inside countries, sometimes those stigmas can persist. So in Germany, for example, there's still, of course, like a very salient memory, and kind of a mode of apology, or a feeling tone of apology. And those can linger, I think. So I'm not exactly sure, when like to systematize this, but I do think that it's at least an interesting question, about how long these reputations can last.
Yeah, exactly. Would it be China that is the most human, that is perceived as the most human rights violator state, or some other states are more?
It's a loaded question,
Yeah.
and it's really, really hard to say. And that's because, first, there are a lot of different kinds of human rights. So as we were talking earlier, are we talking physical integrity rights? Are we talking socioeconomic rights? Are we talking about discrimination, minorities, and so on? It's oftentimes these violations are hidden, so we don't have information on them. And if you see a country that seems to be getting worse in its human rights violations over time, it's hard to know whether it's really getting worse on the ground or if we just have more information about it. And for that reason, it's not only difficult to say which country is, the quote unquote worst. Of course, we can probably talk about like some countries that, according to Amnesty International Human Rights Watch, tend to, have the reputation of being the worst of the worst, but it's hard to make kind of fine grained distinctions. And it's especially even hard to know if human rights are improving as a secular trend over time. There's an interesting debate in political science about this, about whether in general across the world are human rights getting better over time, or especially, which is a difficult, that's a hard question to answer because the standards of human rights have also changed over time. I am not I can't say, of course, whether China is, the worst or better or whatever, but I will say that, Perhaps if we were in China right now, there's maybe a podcast going on, someone asking, is the United States the worst human rights violator in the world or whatever? And I'm not saying that everything is relative, of course, but it's only just to point out how politicized these conversations are,
I see.
and how kind of important our perspective is.
Yeah, I totally get your point. That's true. So my last question would regard other example, and I wanted to ask you, what kind of shaming mechanism do you observe in the context of the Russian invasion of Ukraine? What is the role played here by a non-state actor, so the EU?
I think that this is interesting because I think that Putin greatly underestimated the extent to which the invasion of Ukraine in 2022 would generate outrage, international outrage. He made a miscalculation there. And in some ways, it's not difficult to see how he made that miscalculation. It just a few months before the invasion in December 2021, there was a vote in the United Nations on a resolution condemning Russia for aggression in Crimea. Okay. And during that vote, there were something like 62 yays. So 62 countries chose to condemn Russia, 22 countries no, and the rest abstained. Okay. So if you're looking, if I'm Putin, I'm looking at that. I'm thinking, okay, if I invade Ukraine, maybe I'll get some pushback from Europe and from the United States and the NATO countries, the Western Alliance. But I can just fight back against that by saying that this is just an instance of weaponized shaming and that they're biased against us and they're anti-Russia and they're motivated from their own geopolitical interest and so on. Okay. In March of the following year, there was another vote. This was after Russia decided to go for it. And this time, the resolution was condemning the recent invasion of Ukraine. And this time there were 141 yeses. So 141 countries condemned Russia, and only 5 countries voted no. So Russia had lost many of the of much of the support of countries, especially Latin America, Africa, East Asia, even countries in its voting bloc, like Cuba. North Korea, Nicaragua abstained. I mean, these are countries that always support Russia and the United Nations. Taking that together, it's one thing to dismiss outrage from the European Union or NATO. It's kind of more difficult to dismiss outrage and condemnation that's coming from the global South. So I think there's like kind of a lot more to be said there, but the basic point is that I think if Putin maybe knew how globally unpopular the invasion would be, maybe he would have thought differently about it. The role of the EU and other non-state actors, I think that this is tricky because, again, we have to think about the critic and their relationship to the target. So I admit that I am not an expert on this, but if I were just to think about my theory and apply it to this situation, again, I would probably intuitively think that criticism that is coming from countries that have been sympathetic to Russia in the past is going to be a lot more forceful than countries that have or actors, organizations that has been historically antagonistic towards Russia. That doesn't mean that they don't have a role. And that doesn't mean that they're unimportant or that they should stand back and do nothing or any of these things. But they could perhaps serve a role in supporting Ukraine in other ways. But I will be looking, probably really carefully at other kinds of NGOs, human rights organizations, countries, actors that can't be dismissed as easily as quote unquote anti-Russia.
Thank you very much. On this note, we will end our conversation. So, thank you very much once again for talking to us. And I think it was very insightful and perceptive.
Thanks again for having me.
If you would like to be updated with our newest podcasts and op-eds, do follow us on the biggest social media platforms or sign up to our newsletter.